back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm so happy to be joined by my colleague, Victoria Marshall, staff writer at the Federalist. Victoria, correct me if I'm wrong. This is your first time on the program, right?
Yes, it is my first time on the program. So thanks so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. This is Election Day, and it is the perfect day to have Victoria on the program. Now, the goal of this particular episode is going to actually be to kind of stay as general as possible so that whether you're listening on Tuesday, on Election Day, or on Wednesday, or even Thursday and Friday, you'll have a good idea of a lot of the issues that have been cropping up over the course of the cycle when it comes to election integrity. Because Victoria, you sort of have been doggedly on the election integrity beat for months now, picking up the baton from the one and only Molly Hemingway in some of these places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, just looking at what was happening. There are so many court cases.
Way too many.
There were so many changes to the election system in 2020. And now there are modifications layered on top of those modifications. And I think a lot of folks, as ballots start rolling in today, are going to have many, many questions. And there's going to be so many questions tomorrow, whether in Philadelphia, which seems like it's going to be a hot spot already today on Tuesday. We're taping this around 3 p.m. We have indications that there are going to be potentially a lot of delays in certain places. And Victoria's going to help us sort of understand the broader context that a lot of this happened in. And I'll say also, the listenership was so kind and sent some emails over the course of the last couple of days after we asked for them on yesterday's show. So I'll make sure to read those at the end of today's program. Now, Victoria, you have covered this beat. You came to us from the New York Post, but you have started covering this beat just the nittiest of the grittiest when it comes to election integrity. Overall, what has surprised you as you've covered these issues?
Sorry, I'm still not sure about that.
I'm leaving this in the episode because as soon as I asked Victoria the question, Siri responded to the question for Victoria.
Me.
Frightening, very frightening. Victoria, though, what sort of surprised you as you've gotten into this beat?
I guess how there are so many different laws in all about related to election integrity and just the different election laws across the country that you can't really like paint the election integrity picture with like a broad brushstroke. Like there's just a lot of detailed minutia, like all the different laws. It's really confusing to try and keep it all straight. So with my work with the Federalist, my reporting at the Federalist, I've just had to focus on one state at a time to not get overwhelmed. Like you mentioned previously, there's been court case after court case, whether it's about undated mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania, whether it's about, restricting the rights of poll watchers in Michigan. It's just you have to focus on one state at a time and also one issue at a time.
Right.
And so that's what I've been trying to do to try and make the topic as digestible for our readers and for someone like me.
I was going to say, how did it become digestible to you? Because when I ask you questions about it, you're completely literate and you understand what's happening. And you've been on this beat. I mean, you've been on this beat for a while now, but it's not easy stuff to understand. And honestly, if I'm admitting it, when I look at your headlines, my eyes glaze over sometimes.
Oh, me too.
Because it's so detailed and so granular.
Yeah.
And it's just so outside of my interest areas.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I also think that's how the left and Democrats are able to get away with pushing, kind of unlawful election measures through the state legislatures, through the Secretary of State's offices. Is it because they're so boring sounding?
Right.
And so, just Americans you read what they're doing or what they're trying to pass and you're like, oh, that sounds fine. Cause normally they just slap like some stupid name on it, like voting rights legislation. And you're like, okay. And then you go and you read in it and then it's like, oh, this is so boring. Your eyes glaze over. But then if you're actually paying attention and if you kind of know like what the hell they're doing, you're like, oh, wait, they're taking over our elections. They're trying to federalize our elections. They're trying to like kind of sneak in kind of this whole Democratic get out the vote effort or pass, mass unsupervised mail-in balloting. So
yeah,
it's definitely been a process for me to try and understand what's going on. Molly Hemingway's reporting and also her writing has been really helpful in making it digestible to me, and also her book Rigged. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, it does.
Yeah, it's been hard for me as well.
No, it does make sense. And actually, that's a really helpful way to put it, because if you think about what Mark Zuckerberg did in 2020, it was all cloaked in this language of what was the name of the group, like civic.
Oh yeah. The Center for Tech and Civic Life. Yeah. So which sounds like great and kind of like, you know, kind of hip.
It's like the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, you mean, they funneled $419 million of money from Zuckerberg and his wife, their like nonprofit, to fund Democratic Get Out of the Vote efforts in specific Democrat heavy blue counties of swing states. And so they were able to kind of get out the vote for Democrats and juice Democratic votes.
So you wrote just this morning, I think, maybe it was last night or maybe it was this morning. Mm-hmm. You wrote just recently about the Department of Justice dispatching poll watchers to overwhelmingly Democratic precincts. Can you explain a little bit what happened there?
Yeah, of course. So
announced that today or yesterday?
They announced it yesterday. So on election night. Yeah, exactly. The DOJ just announced that they are going to be sending their attorneys, specifically under the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which deals with enforcing like voting rights, federal voting rights legislation. So under the guise of that, they're going to be going to Democratic heavy counties and also blue counties and swing states to kind of police GOP poll workers and Republican poll watchers, because as Molly also wrote about this week about kind of the big election integrity movement, finally Republicans, Republican poll watchers and the Republican National Committee are able to kind of work together and ensure our elections are conducted freely and fairly. And so now that that's a threat to Democrats kind of maneuvering and electioneering behind the scenes, the DOJ is basically ensuring that they're going to try and interfere with the efforts of the GOP poll watchers. And it's concerning, basically.
Right. Well, which states and cities, as you've been reporting all this out, have been the worst offenders?
The worst offenders, I would say Michigan and Pennsylvania.
Okay, and you actually went to school in Michigan, so you know the landscape a bit.
I love Michigan, actually. It's a great state.
So tell us what Gretchen Whitmer is up to in Michigan.
So I'm actually not focused on Gretchen Whitmer, although she's a terrible Democratic partisan hack. I'm focused more on the Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson,
who's also
a partisan hack. So in the 2020 election, she had a Democratic nonprofit organization that basically, with the Zuckbucks money, so Mark Zuckerberg sending, you know, millions of dollars to different swing states to fund Democratic Get Out the Vote efforts, that money was supposed to go to the secretaries of state's offices. Mm-hmm. But in Michigan, it didn't go to the Benson Secretary of State office. It went to her Democratic nonprofit, which then sent the money to Democratic consulting firms to then get it, like, fund Democratic Get Out the Vote efforts. So she's just a super partisan hack. I wrote a couple of pieces about Benson trying to restrict the rights of poll watchers and her, like, this lengthy poll watcher manual, once again, trying to, you know, put all these, like, rules and enforcing them on GOP poll watchers. And then, you know, Republicans be like, wait, what just happened? Because it's like this massive document and it's really boring and your eyes glaze over, but then you're realizing they're actually restricting the rights of GOP poll watchers and workers.
What, how do they specifically target Republican poll watchers?
Well, it's stuff like, so in absentee balloting, this is one example, but in like the absentee county, like, counting rooms,
the actual
in Michigan,
places where they're like counting the absentee
When they're counting absentee ballots, one of the rules that Benson implemented, which was later thankfully struck down by a Michigan district judge, she basically said that you can't have any kind of recording equipment. Therefore, like, basically what that means is like poll watchers can't record if they see any nefarious activity.
Okay.
And so therefore they'll have no evidence when they're able to report or talk to the election inspector after the fact.
So it's not necessarily that it targets Republican poll watchers so much as that it would.
By effect, it will hamper Republican poll watchers.
Right. It will disproportionately affect people who want to check Democratic officials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So these are happening in Democratic counties where if there are Democratic areas of the state, I'm guessing. I'm just, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
No, I'm trying to understand. Right.
That's a great assumption. That's what it's covering, basically.
Right. So they're taking advantage of that to make accountability more difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I can't remember some of the other things she was doing. I can look that up really quick. But she's also fighting against taking off like 26,000 dead people. Known
dead
people.
She doesn't want to purge the rolls.
From the voter rolls. Exactly. So the Public Interest Legal Foundation has sued the Department of State of Michigan, I think multiple times, and they're in a lawsuit with her right now, and she's fighting that lawsuit because she wants to keep the dead people on the voter rolls, but the National Voter Registration Act requires secretaries of states to clean their voter rolls. I mean, that shouldn't be a partisan issue.
No.
But it is a partisan issue because Democrats benefit off of having inflated voter rolls.
Tell us how. It sounds like an obvious question.
Yeah.
And does it have to do with... Okay, you just explain that first.
It's basically like it's mail-in ballot fraud.
Mm-hmm, okay.
I mean, they...
And mail-in makes it easier to take advantage of the inflated voter roll.
Yes.
Okay.
It does. Basically, I don't have any like hard reporting on it, but it's more of like an assumption of what happens is that they... Democrat or dead people vote in elections. We saw that with 2016. We saw that in 2020. So, and they tend to vote Democrat as well, or they overwhelmingly vote Democrat when you look at it. And so Democrats kind of take advantage of dead people on the voter rolls and somehow register them to vote, especially when you have mass mail-in unsupervised.
Well, they're already registered, right?
Registered. And when you have unsupervised mail-in balloting, mm-hmm. you can just slip that in.
And so that is just one of many, many concerns, obviously, Victoria. It's not, I think the idea that, votes from deceased Americans are going to sway an election to a different side is not the case.
No.
But it's what you're saying is that it's one of many sort of tweaks that Democratic officials have made that is problematic, and it's just sort of part of a package of changes that they've tried to induce.
Exactly. 100%. I mean, it's just one part of the picture of what Democrat officials and leftist partisans do to swing elections in their favor.
The stuff is so convoluted, and focusing on any given issue kind of opens up a Pandora's box of really difficult legal and partisan challenges that make it hard to come away with a clear picture of what's happening. And without any cynicism, there has to be. The more closely you look at what's happened to the most high tech country in like the history of the world, basically, it's just amazing at what a mess our election system is, Victoria. Mm-hmm. And maybe a good question for you is, what concerns you most right now on election day? Is there an area you're particularly worried about? Is there a law that's getting tested, stress tested today you're particularly worried about?
It's more about what I can't see. So I'm referring to an article that I wrote that actually was published today, but it's talking about kind of this last night also on election eve. Mm-hmm. There's this coordinated media campaign by mainstream corporate media, all kind of warning the American public not to expect election results on election day. And it was like they all published it at the exact same time. And it was like, and they were normalizing this concept of an election week or, mm-hmm. God forbid, an election month. And they were saying, oh, well, mail-in ballot and absentee ballots, it's going to take days for these polling locations to accurately count ballots. And so it may look like there's a red wave on election night. It may look like Republicans are ahead, but that's really a red mirage.
The red mirage,
which
right.
is just, that terrified me because it's the exact same strategy or playbook that they used in 2020, where basically Republicans look like they're ahead in the polls, or on election night, and then you get these ballot dumps, you know, the next day, or even, you know, in the, during the 2020 election, it was like the middle of the night. You know, Trump had like was way ahead in the swing states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and then the next day Biden was like made up for, was basically way ahead of Trump, and right. You know, voters are like, what's going on? And then Democrats like, oh, it was just, you know, absentee ballots, mail-in ballots, and you're like, that is so fishy, and they're doing that again, and that just scares me.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I read the full Vox article, and you just alluded to this argument, but their counter argument is that mail-in ballots tend to skew Democrat. People yeah. who vote early and vote by mail tend to be voting Democrat. And so in states where mail-in ballots are counted last, because there are certain laws that say you can't, and certain states have laws that say we don't count mail-in ballots until after the polls close. Because of those laws, that means you do get ballot dumps, that mm-hmm. the timing mm-hmm. is such that polls close, and by the time those absentee ballots, which lean Dem, start getting counted, you know, Republicans would have to have a very substantial sort of lead to make up for what might happen in a Democratic favored ballot dump from counting mail-ins.
Yeah, I understand the argument, and it makes sense, but it's also like, you know, as the United States of America, we are like number two on like the most technologically advanced countries in the world. We should be able to count, even if there's like, you know, thousands of mail-in ballots in all these different polling places across the country, we should still be able to count them by election night. There's no reason why we shouldn't count them. And yeah, it's just, honestly, we shouldn't even have early voting. We shouldn't have mail-in ballots. We should be like France. France only has paper ballots. They've banned mail-in ballots, and they're able to determine election results or who the winner is within 24 hours. There's no reason the United States cannot do that. Yeah. I mean, we used to always have election results on election day. You know, people would still vote absentee, but we just have this huge, like, mass unsupervised mail-in balloting scheme because of the COVID-19 pandemic, which mm-hmm. that was just an excuse to enable all these mass mail-in balloting in, you know, all these blue states or in swing states. And it enables Democrats to figure out how many votes they need, and then find it in the mail-in ballots and the absentee ballots.
You really think that?
I think that, yeah.
I mean, hey, you cover this stuff that. Close.
Yeah, it's just, it's concerning to me. And I mean, right now, Republicans...
Well, and to be fair, you said it enables. So mm-hmm. the laws are such that they can be exploited if a bad actor wanted to exploit them.
Exactly.
And people who are called election deniers are often lumped in and conflated with people who had these crazy ideas about fraud and...
Oh, yeah, like Sidney Powell and the Kraken. Which
right.
I'm still waiting on that.
Exactly, Victoria. And so there's this mass conflation. And even like people that I think are a little out there, I look at what they've actually said. And I'm like, that is not election denialism. It's just this idea that there are huge gaping holes. And nobody's mm-hmm. saying that they were exploited. Mm-hmm. They're saying that they might have been exploited.
Exactly.
And it's not unreasonable to say that, because other countries are able to do this much more securely. And this is obviously a vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'll believe the Red Mirage argument when we don't have mass, no excuse mail-in voting.
Well,
we don't have early voting.
This is what I wanted to ask you. You were saying because of the pandemic, we now have this mass mail-in voting operation, and it's especially prevalent in certain swing states.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me more about, like, did any of these laws... Molly wrote a long piece that you talked about earlier about how Republicans actually did fight for securing elections in places like Georgia. And if they do well tonight, they will have those efforts partly from the RNC, partly from Republican governors, to thank for the fact that a lot of Republican voters felt confident enough to come out and cast ballots, and that, you know, they're able to tabulate this stuff with a high degree of certainty in a timely manner, like a reasonably timely manner. But that said, how many of the problems that you're worried about tonight are actually just, you know, still new enough that they're coming from law changes that happened in 2020?
I don't know specifically or state by state which states still allow no excuse mail-in balloting.
But it's a lot.
It's a lot of states.
Yeah.
I hesitate on Georgia, the example you use. I know I don't know if they still allow no excuse mail-in balloting. There's still mail-in ballots, but I'd have to get back on you on that. But basically,
but they passed that law. The Brian Kemp sort of midwifed that law into existence.
Yeah,
and voter turnout is up. And yeah. Clearly people in Georgia seem to be voting just fine.
Yeah, there's no voter suppression.
There's no voter suppression. Oh, yeah. Even though Stacey Abrams has now, and the tell is that Stacey Abrams has shifted from talking about, voter oppression, Jim Crow 2.0, as the president himself called it. But she's talking about how black male voters have been targets of disinformation. Right. Like
that's hilarious.
That's the vulnerability in Georgia's election system now from the left perspective is disinformation. And we've seen the same thing sort of tried in Florida. Florida and Texas with Hispanic voters.
Yeah, exactly. Because minority voter turnout is up. So all their claims of voter suppression or like specifically targeting minorities and trying to like wrestle the right to vote for them, it's not true. Mm-hmm. And also minority voters like are able to get IDs and be able to like they favor voter ID.
Yeah.
So it's like ridiculous to call that a voter suppression tactic, especially against black and brown bodies.
Ridiculous and borderline racist. And
yeah, it is racist.
It's like, it's just outrageously stupid. But okay, so there are reports already from two places I want to zero in on. One would be Maricopa County in Arizona, mm-hmm. and the other would be Philadelphia. Let's start in Maricopa County, where it has been widely reported, by local media outlets and people on the ground there that voting machines,
like 20% in Maricopa County are down.
They're down.
Or they've experienced some sort of shortage or at one point during the day or have been down. And
what do we know about this? Basically that. That's the extent of what we know.
Basically that.
And Katie Hobbs, who is Democratic Party's gubernatorial nominee in Arizona, if I'm not mistaken, oversees Arizona's elections.
Yeah, which she should definitely recuse herself, which is what Carrie Lake has been saying. And she hasn't been. It's horrifying because it's a clear conflict of interest. And if I was an Arizonan, I would be horrified and I wouldn't trust the results in Arizona.
So what else should we know about what's happened in Arizona? Is there anything else interesting that's sort of percolated behind the scenes? Because that was a hot spot in 2020. And obviously that's one of the pivotal moments of 2020 is when Fox called Arizona, which a lot of people thought was a premature call.
Yes.
Since then, a lot of people are actually wondering, I've seen it just online today, people being like, wait. We have all these problems specifically in Maricopa County in 2020. And we are like 2 hours into voting being open in Maricopa County
and
the machines are down? Or what, how does that happen?
I'm so disappointed. That's another thing that I'm really scared about, I guess, today on this election day, because I really don't know much going on other than just like anecdotal reports or things you see on Twitter, which are hard to verify.
Because you're here in D.C.
Yeah, I'm here in D.C. And also, I don't know, you just need to verify everything that you see on Twitter or any kind of like shaky cell phone video about Maricopa County, because they're meant to be kind of inflammatory anyway. But basically, I think it's absolutely ridiculous and there should be no excuse for these counties who in 2020 had major problems and major administrative issues to have them again in 2022 after we've had like a whole, like 2 whole years to fix these problems after, you know, Americans clearly have a lot of skepticism about the administration of our elections and are very distrustful of the elections process. This just will hurt the credibility of Maricopa County's, you know, Board of Elections even more, or just increase voter skepticism of whether the elections in Arizona are free and fair.
I don't know what I'm supposed to think. I mean, I really, really, in a lot of these cases, I go back and I have no idea. You can read news report after news report and still have no idea what to think. And Arizona has been one of those places because you can tell, obviously, that there's funny business going on.
Yeah.
And you can tell, obviously, that there are crazy people who are not explaining the crazy business responsibly or helpfully constructively. And so it's like, get to the bottom of what's actually happening. It's impossible.
I would agree. I just, that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to comment on what's going on in Maricopa County, because I just don't know enough. And I don't want to say, oh, it's election fraud. you know, because I don't want to be conspiracy theorists, but it's definitely, I'm definitely, definitely skeptical of what's going on. And I'm disappointed that it's a mess already, you know.
Right. Now let's shift to Philadelphia, where...
Oh, also, can I just mention something
please,
really quick?
Please, please.
So it's also deeply disappointed, because like we said, mail-in ballots skew Democratic. So most Republican voters vote in person and on election day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these Maricopa County, you know, polling locations with their election machines, you know, shutting down, or 20% of the election machines shutting down, and voters are unable to vote, that affects Republicans most.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, can you really expect a Republican voter who has to go to work or is taking time out of their day to wait an hour, sometimes 2 hours, until the election machines, you know, are up and running again to cast their vote?
Mm-hmm.
It is voter disenfranchisement, basically. It is voter suppression.
Mm.
And that concerns me, because Arizona is a key battleground state this election cycle, and the Democrats know that too. So it's really frustrating.
Well, and what's strange about that in particular is, so this question of voter suppression exists on a spectrum, and it makes it, the way the left talks about voter suppression makes it impossible to mount a serious counterargument against them, because every step towards a more secure election or a more restrictive election, if we want to use literal definitions, is suppression, right? So if you do something like they call voter ID suppression, because there's some small slice of the population that doesn't have voter ID, or that doesn't have an identification or a driver's license and won't go and get it. Thus, they are being suppressed, even though it is perfectly reasonable to expect every American citizen should have a voter ID, or should have an identification, whether they drive or not. They should have a piece of identification, and it's not asking too much of the public to do that, let alone to vote. Even if there's no evidence of widespread voter ID fraud, it's just something that increases the security of the election. It makes it easier for poll watchers to verify these things. It's smoother and it's safer.
Exactly.
And anything on that spectrum is what they call voter suppression.
Mm-hmm. And all that should be nonpartisan issues.
Right. And this is like, today I've just had a really bad feeling, not about like whether it's a red wave or a blue wave or whatever, but just a really bad feeling about our ability to function as a country. And not even because of what we've seen out of Maricopa County, but because of, what people are going to think about what happens around the country and what might happen around the country. I mean, I don't know, but I know that everyone feels like this is broken. And this election already, the fact that this is a perfect shift from Maricopa County to Philadelphia, where right now, we already have people saying we are probably not going to know what happens in Philadelphia until tomorrow at the earliest? At the earliest.
A couple of days.
Because they are bickering about this date question.
Oh, yeah. The undated mail-in ballot.
Tell us what's happening in Philadelphia. And now I believe Mark Elias is involved.
Oh, yeah. Well, basically, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled earlier in October that mail-in ballots, undated mail-in ballots, cannot be counted. And then the Pennsylvania Secretary of State, Leigh Chapman, basically told all 67 of Pennsylvania's counties to disregard that order.
Why?
Because she,
just going back and forth about the legality.
Yeah, and forth about the legality. She said that's not what the law says. And I mean,
these are legal quibbles that are having massive consequences very close to the election.
Yeah, exactly. But Pennsylvania law clearly states that undated mail-in ballots cannot be counted. And it literally says that on the literature and the instructions if you receive a mail-in ballot from Pennsylvania. It says it twice, like in the instructions and also in the mail-in ballot, mail-in or absentee ballot itself. So what that would mean is that the 67 counties in Pennsylvania, like, some of them will count undated mail ballots and some of them won't, because some of them will be following the law and some will be following Chapman's directive. And so that just kind of leads to voter disenfranchisement, because some voters, like, or voters' ballots being diluted, because some of the undated kind of fraudulent ballots will be counted, mm-hmm, and mixed in with the dated ballots. And so, but thankfully the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, I don't know, all these days kind of blur together with election integrity stuff in my mind, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the Republican National Committee, Republican National Committee and the Pennsylvania GOP sued Pennsylvania because of Chapman's directive to the 67 Pennsylvania counties being like, disregard the U.S. Supreme Court order about undated mail-in ballots. So luckily, Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled in and said, actually, no, you have to follow the law. You cannot count the undated mail-in and absentee ballots. Mm-hmm. And so now kind of the mainstream media has kind of gone in on the whole battle, because I read a sob story by the Washington Post about how all these voters who did not date their ballots are being disenfranchised, and they have to go back and then vote in person or wait in long lines. And it's, you know, it's racist and all of that. And it's kind of like, reading that article, I just thought, why didn't these voters date their ballots? Mm-hmm. Like, it's really not that hard. You just sign and date your ballot. But so that's kind of what's happening right now.
So Democrats are suing or taking some legal action to overturn the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Yeah. Over dating ballots, which shouldn't, I feel like, just
even
like
though it's
ID,
in the Constitution or in the Pennsylvania Constitution,
in state law,
in state
law, it's just a federal statute with election law in Pennsylvania. And it's just kind of crazy to me, because I feel like it's just common sense, like voter ID, like, yeah, you date your ballot.
Yep.
And that's just how that works.
But they're saying that it's immaterial what date is on the ballot, basically, because it has to be in by election day.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Right.
Which is there. I mean, that's an argument you can make, but that's not what Pennsylvania law says. But that's what Mark Elias is fighting for.
And it's going to slow down the count.
Yes. Yeah, it will.
And why is that? Because they have to sort.
Yeah, so a part of one of the laws that the Pennsylvania Republican legislature passed was that I don't actually remember, but basically counting mail-in and absentee ballots kind of takes more time, or I don't remember.
So,
to verify the ballot, it causes counting to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I just pulled up from the Philadelphia Inquirer. It says city officials voted Tuesday morning as polling places opened and the vote count began for the midterm elections to reinstate a time-consuming and labor-intensive process for catching double votes.
Oh yeah,
that will
it.
Slow how quickly they can report the results. So it's not just it's this came in response, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. It says that was a sudden reversal of a decision they made less than a week ago, and came a day after a city judge responding to a Republican lawsuit said they could move forward without the process. This is insane. Maybe this is completely insane. Why is this all playing out within days?
That's just how elections work in Philly. I'm just going to say, because Philly has always just been a hot mess. And, you know, Democrats are always going to try and rig the elections in Philly and use election law for their advantage or for the disadvantage of Republicans.
Yeah. And again, all of this stuff exists. Like, there's an element of semantics to this, and there's sort of like a spectrum to this, because, you know, people would say, and I guarantee you there are some Republicans in positions of power who will say, yeah, we do want to do voter ID because we do think it'll be helpful to Republicans on the margins. I'm sure there are some that would say that behind closed doors, even though the argument for it is completely solid and sound. It needn't have a single thing to do with what will actually happen in the tabulation. But what you're saying basically is that that's the way Democrats manipulate election law too, that it's just a matter of like suing in the right places and passing the right laws, or suing to stop the passage of different laws to get all of this to work out, which seems to
me in their favor.
And you know, there's an element of federalism to that as well, right? That we have this different patchwork of laws because we trust the states and not the federal government to handle a lot of this. That's the way our system is set up. But holy smokes, this is a mess.
Yep. It's a mess. I mean, that's, you just summed it up perfectly. It's a mess. And Democrats are just going to try and work around different laws in order to, you know, rig elections in their favor or find the necessary Democratic votes, whether that's through, you know, undated mail-in ballots, whether they can be counted or not, or yeah, this process for counting double votes.
I see what you're saying. So like, and this is what you were talking about earlier, that when you start going through mail-in ballots and there's some that are undated and they're going in one direction or another direction, counting those in a very slim race or in a very sort of slimly
will make all the difference
they
for
can
Democrats.
Make a, they can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's because, again, like there's this line from the media that every sort of fear about this is just irrational conspiracy mongering. And it's not to say there aren't irrational conspiracy mongers out there, of course. And I actually think they make this conversation a whole lot more difficult. Like, what if there had never been a Kraken conversation in 2020?
Yeah. No,
we would just be talking about how Zuckerberg spent $410 million.
$419 million.
Goodness gracious!
I know, and that, and more Americans would believe it and trust it. Well, I don't know, not the mainstream media.
The media wouldn't want to talk.
It would be more credible,
right?
But for people like you know, Molly Hemingway and my other colleague Sean Fleetwood, who cover election integrity issues at the Federalist, we're constantly having to just overcome this huge, just like being characterized election deniers or just. I mean, wade through all these like crazy, like boomer conspiracy theories through like Reddit forums. And you're like, okay, we're trying to find what's the actual story?
Boomer conspiracy theories on Reddit forums, which is not, that is, speaking of reconciliation, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to reconcile that idea. Those are probably on Facebook.
Yes, you're true. Thank you. Yeah, I misspoke. I apologize.
Mad love to all of our boomer listeners. We love you guys. And, you know, I feel like our boomer listeners are very sort of self reflective and aware.
Yeah, definitely. Great.
Victoria, before we shift to some of our listener emails, can you just, is there anything that we've missed in this conversation that people should know about? As you've started on this beat, is there anything that people should know about?
Yeah, I think what's been really encouraging to me is the article that Molly Hemingway wrote actually on Monday morning, talking about kind of the gains, or last Friday, actually, the gains of the election integrity movement and how involved the RNC has been and these grassroots election integrity activists around the country in, you know, advocating for a free and fair elections in the United States, whether the, through the RNC's like lawsuits, like most, like a lot of the lawsuits I was mentioning earlier about regarding the Jocelyn Benson, Michigan Secretary of State. You know, she's was sued multiple times by the RNC. And, you know, like there's just been this, the RNC has like hundreds of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but I know there's been like 122,000 volunteers signed up through different polling locations across the country because of the RNC's efforts.
Right.
It's just, they have people on the ground in most like notable polling locations that we want to keep our eyes on across the country, especially in Democrat areas of swing states. So I think also we should be encouraged about the steps the RNC and Republican election integrity activists have taken in trying to ensure our elections are free and fair. So I don't want to end this on like a sad note, but also be encouraged that people are fighting for your vote and fighting for voters' voices to be heard.
Even though the media will portray them eagerly.
As election deniers, yes.
Right, which has happened to what, Cleta Mitchell's group?
Yeah, the Election Integrity Network, which is doing great work.
But the media has been very harsh on them.
They have been it. They've been focused on changing election laws that are clearly unconstitutional or illegal and disenfranchise voters. They haven't been, you know, coming up with these crazy claims or conspiracies about how the 2020 election was stolen. It was rigged, or they've been focusing on actual instances of election fraud and fighting that and training, you know, concerned citizen voters to be poll watchers in their local elections.
Gosh,
that's what they've been doing, and they're castigated as election deniers.
It's just, again, like I said, I couldn't figure out, you know, I mean, I guess it was fairly obvious to me at some point, but I've just had such a pit in my stomach all day, and it's really hard to watch this. And Victoria, you're younger than me, sort of significantly younger than me at this point, but I wonder, you know, if this is what your impression of the country was growing up, because for me, it feels like a really, like, it feels like a departure. But I mean, I lived through the 2000 election. I was really young. But I feel like for a lot of people, that was a very disillusioning moment. But it seems like even the low watermark of national sort of faith in our election institutions that probably happened after we were in that, after the 2000 election, it feels like we're sort of, we've blown past that. But I guess maybe myself, I'm not even old enough to realize that, but I'm curious about somebody who was born, what, after 9/11? Am I right about that?
No, before 9/11.
Right before?
Right before 9/11. Wow. So I'm a 90. I was born in 1997.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, well, then I thought you were younger than, like, a lot younger than me, but congratulations, Victoria.
Thank you.
I'm a little
older than you thought I was.
Your mid-20s.
I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing.
Congratulations on being in your mid-20s.
Thank you.
But, okay, so, but what is your sort of Gen Z perspective on if this
on
feels like
a, in America?
Well, does it feel like a different country than the one you grew up in?
Yes. My dad and my mom were always involved in local politics growing up where I lived in Southern California. And so my assumption was always that elections were conducted fair and square. I mean, there might be a little bit of election fraud here and there, but
right.
It wasn't enough, to kind of turn the results of the election. And there wasn't this kind of like insane leftist machine, like, or a propaganda campaign, you know, with the media as well as, these woke corporations or like social media companies trying to, swing elections in the Democratic candidate's favor. Mm-hmm. That was never on my radar. It was just, I had trust and faith in our elections, and until the 2020 election. And that was when I lost faith. And it felt like we were living in a banana republic because all of our institutions were colluding with the Democrats in order to swing the election in Joe Biden's favor. And that's what happened. I mean, you saw that with social media, in major corporations, telling everyone to go out and vote and just, basically telling everyone that Trump was a very good, no bad, horrible man.
Bad, no good, horrible man.
Sorry, I didn't say that very well, but you get what I mean. But yeah, I am. It's hard for me because it's hard for me to trust election results because so much is against, I guess, my side or working against my side. And
Well, I think a lot of this is downstream of something that we talk about a lot on the show, which is consensus, that we used to have a consensus about what constituted suppression. And we debated voter ID, there was a much more basic consensus. And that's not, again, to say that any of this is unprecedented in the course of the country. I mean, obviously, we've had many, many problems with enfranchisement. We've had Tammany Hall. We've had this is not the only time that we've dealt with these problems on a significant level in our national history, far from it. But to your point, Victoria, the level of cooperation between our major institutions, media, tech, the Democratic establishment, is academia. Like, it is just remarkable. And media, I think, in particular, is probably one of the biggest barriers here to having a consensus. Because if the media had covered what was happening with that Georgia bill we talked about earlier accurately, then the MLB wouldn't have done what the MLB did.
Exactly.
Then we wouldn't have had this entire conversation about Jim Crow 2.0 coming out of the president's mouth. I mean, he would never be able to get away with talking about Jim Eagle or Jim Crow 2.0 mm-hmm. because in a healthy media ecosystem, he would get absolutely castigated night after night after night for that level of inflammatory and false, misleading, deceitful rhetoric.
Exactly. And also just to have Democrats in the media basically say that if you vote for the right or a Republican candidate this election cycle, you're basically like, democracy will die. You're voting to kill democracy. That never would have been the case, you know, in 20, even 2012
mm-hmm.
or 2008.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. Even though our institutions were clearly aligned with the left, it's just kind of crazy how the Overton window has shifted.
Yes.
That you can just like mainstream media figures can be like, democracy is at stake.
About mail-in ballots. Yeah.
Yeah. About if you vote for the other party,
right.
The party that represents like half of the American people. That is the only other party to vote for. And they're like, you have to vote for just the Democrats. Like, that's insane.
Or if you crack down on people handing out water bottles in line to vote, that's the difference between, that is where you cross the fine line between democracy and fascism.
I know.
Water bottles in line at a polling place. And mm-hmm. it's just like insane.
You're no better than Jefferson Davis if you, prevent people from handing out food at the polls.
But remember when that election law came out, it was like Joe Biden's state, his home state of Delaware, has stricter election laws than this Georgia bill would implement in Georgia. Georgia.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was no media. There was no tech fact checks of that. There was nothing. I mean, it was just, I mean, there may have been something here or there, but broadly, he got away with it. Hollywood let him get away with it. Media let him get away with it.
Yeah, big tech let him get away with it. When just they should have fact checked him.
Well, yeah. So we just had this entire conversation about like the legal quibbling, which is like extremely granular and difficult to follow. But to your point about 2020, we could have a question of, or we could have an entire conversation about the serious election meddling that happened in media and tech, period.
And collusion between like basically the Democratic or the government and big tech. So the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, et cetera, they were all in cahoots with these tech companies.
And then the DOJ enters the picture the night before the election and is sending people to watch polls in overwhelmingly Democratic jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. All right, Victoria, let's shift to listener emails because I have one that I really want to talk about. And just want to say Gregory is the one who sent this particular email. Thank you so much. By the way, we put out that call on yesterday's episode just saying, hey, folks, like this is a crazy week. It's been a crazy cycle. And we so appreciate making us part of your media diet during this cycle. So if you have anything, any questions you want answered, just feel free. Still, please just drop an email over to radio@thefederalist.com. We check that inbox all the time. And I want to just say this is from Gregory. Gregory asks a really, really good question. It's a little bit of a tip too, which I like. And it's some constructive feedback, I think. This is from Gregory. Quote, some shows focused over the next years defining what big questions need to be made the centerpiece of this emerging realignment on the right. And Gregory continues to say, let's get actual legislatures on the show and get these questions some national standardization and hold some feet to the fire and get dedication to committing to this yet to be defined direction. And I love that because if, let's say, Blake Masters wins tonight, if J.D. Vance wins tonight, which he is poised to do despite the fact that media spent... Another thing we could talk about, Victoria, is polls and how polls, partisan polls that are put out sometimes actually under the guise of media outlets, but pure ultimately propaganda. Partisan propaganda, are election meddling in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even get to that. So all that is to say, if these guys win, if there's like a very fresh crop of people who are willing to entertain different ideas about Republicans, about what Republicans should or should not do, if they actually get elected, first of all, part of the reason I'm a journalist is because I do not trust a single person. Like, are there politicians I look at and say, oh, Ron DeSantis, he's onto something? Yeah, absolutely. But you cannot ever trust a politician. And it's always been strange to me. Like, I guess I understand it, but the cheerleading for either Republicans or Democrats, and I don't mean like hoping a Republican wins a race because you're conservative and that's the sort of vehicle for ideas. I mean, actually, you know, there are people here in DC who don't even work for Republicans, but walk around in like GOP ties and, you know, like that I've never been able to understand because there's just both parties are dominated by corruption. But that is to say, I like Blake Masters. J.D. Vance has been on this show. Obviously, there are a lot of people at the Federalist who like the direction that guys like that are going in. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean you take your foot off the gas. And to Gregory's point, the thing should be to hold this new crop of politicians if they're elected tonight or this week, as I should say.
Or this month.
Especially someone like Dr. Oz. Hold their feet to the fire. You appealed to Trump voters, Dr. Oz. Why is your, healthcare policy, why is your corporate policy here or there hurting people? Why aren't you going after Facebook? Why aren't you going after Twitter? Why have you taken your foot off the gas when it comes to immigration?
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely think we should be pushing those politicians, if they get elected, into delivering results for the American people, because that's why they're elected. If they're no different than Democrats, then then they shouldn't have gotten our vote.
And one thing that might give Gregory some comfort to know is that here in DC, and Victoria, this is a question for you, there's really been a wave since Trump, and I don't know how big it is, but of people in their early 20s who have come to DC to kind of work on the so-called new right, or to work on Republican issues, or to work in conservative media, whatever they're doing. that is very suspicious of the old guard and sometimes outright hostile to the old guard. Mm-hmm. And again, it's hard to quantify, you know, what percentage of the conservative movement this is. But Victoria, you tend to have your finger sort of more closely to the pulse of what's happening with the younger crowd. Mm-hmm. But it, my read of it is, and I still work with a lot of students and young people, my reading of it is the energy is on the side of pushing back against Republicans going in the wrong direction, just because that populist wave did bring some personnel infrastructure to D.C.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think most of your young conservative voters are going to be more aligned with the new right or like the nationalist kind of populist kind of turn of the right. And Blake Masters and J.D. Vance kind of represent that. Where you're going to be advocating more for family values, so like conservative cultural policies, but also more economic policies that are more on the left. So making sure or being more protectionist on trade policy. So kind of just following the legacy of Donald Trump and being really skeptical of kind of old guard Republicans that to us look, you know, they just resemble mainline mainstream Democrats. Mm-hmm. And we think they're also just serving the same interests that the Democrats serve because they're all kind of funded by the same people. So really trying to focus on getting results for the American people and have politicians that actually advocate for your everyday American family, you know, in terms of economic policy, making sure like a family can be supported on one income, in terms of cultural issues, whether it's, you know, kind of stopping this whole like trans ideology from being pushed onto young children in schools, or also just from, you know, mutilating their bodies to mm-hmm. become another sex when their brains aren't even fully developed. It's just trying to. It's just concern for the little guy. And I think a lot of people on the new right would say that the, kind of the old guard Republicans don't care about the little guy and they really only care about corporate interests or the people that are funding them.
Well, one thing you can be sure of is that we're not letting anybody off the hook here at the Federalist. Mm-hmm. My favorite thing about the Federalist is that everybody is scattered around the country and doesn't need to worry about their DC cocktail party list. And sometimes, you know, I'll run into somebody like, because Victoria and I are both based here in DC. I'll like run into somebody when I'm getting a train or like at a, you know, but maybe you're just at a bar and you're like, ooh, whoops.
Yeah, yeah. Although I would say, you know, New Right throws but some it's pretty fine. Good cocktail party. I must say.
Oh gosh, I don't want to hear about it. Do not want to hear about it.
They're all the same at the end of the day.
I actually scootered right past Mitch McConnell yesterday.
Oh dear.
not super far from here, but speaking of people that the Federalist is you know, holds accountable. There you have one mm-hmm. example. So Gregory, I think what I'm getting from this email is clarity. You continue, Gregory, seems the opportunity is ripe for discussions leading to a firm and well-defined political party platform with actual goals that will not only help in the upcoming 2024 election, but lay a foundations for decades-long direction changes for the country or for this nation, you write. And yeah, again, like I have no, I mean, sometimes I feel like I'm more angry towards Republicans than Democrats, even though overall Democrats are, Republicans allowed us to get into this position.
Exactly.
Right.
And
so yeah, like
Republicans allowed the mass mail-in balloting with no supervision in 2020.
Yeah.
And like allowed secretaries of state to illegally change election law to allow for those like measures that allowed them to rig elections.
Yeah. And just before we finish up with Gregory here, Gregory has this idea. It says maybe brand these types of episodes to further create a sense of creation and unification. I like that. You know, if you want to listen to our episodes where there are sort of policy suggestions or candidate interviews or member interviews, that we would have a certain label or brand for that's a great idea. And finally, just finishing up with Gregory here, you had big fan of Emily's work and the podcast in general. Very, very kind of you. Thank you. Thanks a bundle. Gregory says, I'll go officially join the Federalist and start subscribing. Been meaning to. I don't know that I've ever actually plugged that on the podcast, but a couple of months ago, we rolled out this feature where you can subscribe to the Federalist, log in, you can add comments, and you can see us commenting, all of our Federalist writers comment on there. So if you're interested, definitely check that out on the website. And Gregory says, am I allowed to submit essays to the Federalist? Any specific email? Yes, 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 yes. That is why we exist, is to platform people who are not professional writers and are voices that DC suppresses and fails to amplify, but that are extremely very much part of a healthy political discourse. info@thefederalist.com. Our submission guidelines are all on the website. Make sure to take a look at that if you're interested in submitting to us. And we really encourage everybody to do that. One final email. This one is so kind. I'm not even going to read it all because it's very nice. but from Alan, who says, I don't identify as a conservative, but I think this show is for almost everyone. I don't share the perspective of some of the guests that are on, but that's the great part about it. I don't have to. I agree completely. That's what I listen for in a podcast, or that's what I look for in a podcast, is that contrast. You know, hopefully we can get back to a country that wants to listen to both William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal and wants to see them, you know, talk to each other, or William F. Buckley bringing on Phyllis Schlafly and Betty Friedan. You know, it felt for a moment like the media wasn't capable of delivering this contrast, but I don't think people ever lost their appetite for that contrast. Alan, this is like such a kind email. And like I said, it would be improper of me to read all of it because it's simply too kind, but mm-hmm. I do really, really appreciate it. And we appreciate all of your feedback. I really like Gregory's tip there to brand some episodes in particular ways. So just as we close out on election night, I just want to thank everybody for a great cycle. I want to thank all of our guests. I want to thank all of our listeners. And I just want to say, you know, all thanks to Ben, who built this show, and so many of you have stuck with Ben for years and have continued to listen. It means a lot. It's just a huge shoes to fill, but I really, really appreciate so many people sticking around. It's awesome, and I love the listeners. And if you have anything to say, just hit up radio@thefederalist.com. We appreciate it. We appreciate feedback, constructive or otherwise. And I just want to also add that, Victoria, we're so glad that you're doggedly on this beat, all over this beat, and we appreciate your time today. And I know that your insight will be invaluable in the days to come as people look around the wreckage of our election system and say, what happened?
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure. And yeah, I hope to keep being a voice for the American people. for election integrity specifically.
You remind me of Lena Dunham's character in Girls saying to her mom and dad, I think I'm the voice of my generation.
That's so cringe. Oh. I didn't mean it like that, but sure.
Yeah, but I'm going to make fun of you.
Yeah, you should, because it was kind of cringe what I said.
No, it wasn't. All right. Victoria, I hope you're able to go have some champagne or something before the results start coming in.
Yeah, me too.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Darling, you got me right.